Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
You've heard the stories. Somewhere out there in the great beyond, the cloud, in some huge server bank, a grumpy goblin fired from Gringotts Wizarding Bank in Diagon Alley for being too malevolent is compiling your digital dossier containing every bit of information that has appeared online about you and then some. I'm your host, Jane Karwoski, experimental psychologist, Dr. J, along with my co-host, Jim Nico, CEO of Social Network Intermedia, LLC. Today, we delve into anonymity. It's not easily achieved, no matter how noble the motivation. Today, to tell us about the difficulty of anonymity, who better than the founder of Anonymizer Incorporated, an internationally recognized expert in cryptography, online privacy, and internet security. Lance Cottrell is a frequent public speaker at conferences such as RSA Security Conference, Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Europe, ISS World, that stands for Intelligence Support Systems for Lawful Interception, Electronic Surveillance, and Cyber Intelligence Gathering. He is principal author on multiple internet privacy and security technology patent applications. He took Anonymizer to a very successful exit in 2008 and is now chief scientist of Entrepid, the acquiring company. And as if that weren't enough, previously he did extensive graduate work in astrophysics. Holds an MS in physics from the University of California, San Diego, and a BS in physics from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Mr. Cottrell.
Thank you so much.
We're honored you're here, and we really appreciate your work. Thank you so much.
Lance, I read on your blog, which I strongly recommend, by the way, theprivacyblog.com, these words. One often hears that some massive collection of data will not have privacy implications because it has been anonymized. Anytime you hear that, treat the statement with great skepticism. It turns out that effectively anonymizing data, making it impossible to identify the individuals in the data set, is much harder than you might think. So please tell us about that and what New York City taxis have to do with it.
Sure. Yeah. You often see cases where people will have large public databases of information, medical research or things like the U.S. Census, and they'll say, we're going to strip out your name and other identifying information so you don't have anything to worry about. But it turns out that there's a lot of ways in which someone can go into those databases and then re-identify all of the participants. And there's kind of two standard ways that that fails. It can fail either because of a technical problem with the way the data was anonymized, or because when you combine all the apparently unrelated bits of data, they turn out to be a unique fingerprint.
So if you have enough points of data, do you have to have a lot to identify someone?
Right. So there's a lot of different kinds of sets of data that could come up. So, for example, it turns out that just given your 5-digit zip code, date of birth, and gender, I can identify uniquely 63% of the population. The more information you add, the better it gets. 9-digit zip codes are actually just about one suburban block. You know, it's a handful of houses. It really quickly gets fine. You know, someone will say, oh, we're just going to use the last 4 digits of your social security number. Well, that's another factor of 10,000 in specificity. So, you know, you might have, you're one of this group of people. If I get the last 4 of your social security number, now I really know who you are.
So just saying, just give me your last 4 is not, given all the other information that could be matched up with that,
Exactly. It's always the combination. You know, the last four digits by itself doesn't identify you. But if I know your date of birth and your last four and what city you live in, maybe, that may be starting to get down to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the taxi situation was the other kind of failure, which was that they actually designed the anonymization wrong.
How so?
Well, they have a database of every single taxi ride in New York by time, location, taxi license, and the medallion. And they hid the medallion number and the license number, and they scrambled them effectively. But the problem is, you know what medallion numbers look like. There's a standard format. There's so many characters, so many letters, so many numbers, whatever. It turns out that there's only 22 million possible medallion numbers. Of course, there's nowhere near that many actual medallions, but that sounds like a lot, and it would be if you were trying to write them on index cards. But for a modest-sized home computer, that's about 2 minutes' work to compute the hash, the cryptographic hash, which is what they used, of all 22 million possible medallion numbers. And then you just look for them in the database, and bam, you know, the actual taxi driver medallion tied to every single trip.
Now, who has this data? Because there's a lot of different taxi companies, correct?
Apparently, it is there's a central database of all taxi transactions in New York kept by the government, and someone got their hands on this through a Freedom of Information Act request, and it was allowed because, you know, this was not considered to be sensitive data because it was all anonymized.
Mm.
And that's the way this happens.
You use the word hash. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. A hash is a cryptographic tool. And the idea is that it's what's called a one-way function. So you can take some information, a document, a license number, something like that. And what comes out the other side is this big, long scrambled number. And it is impossible, or effectively impossible, to go backwards. So given one of these hash outputs, there's no way for me to go back and get the taxi cab medallion number that corresponded to it. So it's one direction only. The problem is, I can guess the inputs. There's only 22 million of them, and I can compute the hashes of all 22 million and then look for the results, because I could do the same forward direction that they did originally. It's only the backwards direction that's impossible.
So if you do the forwards, then you get a whole bunch of possibilities, and then you can see which ones match up.
Exactly. So if I had a database of patient names that were all hashed, it'd just be these long, big list of scrambled numbers. However, if I wanted to see if you were in the database, I could hash your name and then take that hash and look it up in the database and see if it's in there. Now, there are techniques, if someone is thinking about this and doing it right, you can build the system so it's much, much harder to play that trick. But unfortunately, most of the people who are building these databases aren't security experts. They're not privacy experts. You know, they're just trying to get their job done. And so you end up with something that kind of looks good to the layman, but as soon as the security guy gets their hands on it, you know, suddenly everyone's privacy is exposed.
Thank you for that. Is there any kind of, within cryptography or high-level privacy, is there anything that the layman, the person that knows very little about this, can do in regard to maybe passwords or protecting their identity, something they can take away from the show?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to realize how universal this kind of data collection is. And, you know, everything you do, from your cell phone location to your credit cards to your browsing habits, and it's all being captured all the time. So it's important to do two things. One is pay attention to what it is you actually want to protect. It's really unrealistic to think that you're going to protect all of your information all of the time. Pick out those facts that really matter. And then use tools. Use encryption in your email, either the built-in encryption or something like GPG, GNU Privacy Guard, and hide your location on the internet using a tool like, you know, my company's anonymizer.com will allow you to then prevent the websites you're going to from seeing who you are, where you're coming from, and you can then target that against the particular information that you're trying to protect. Let's say, you know, you have very different political leanings to your boss, and you might want to you know, keep that information from showing up in a search about you.
Well, okay, I now feel completely overwhelmed and wonder, oh, how could I possibly even know what information I want to protect? But the question I would have is, how many people are out there gathering that kind of, you know, to unencrypt something, decipher that, and what are they going to do with that information? I mean, is this, how major a threat is that?
I think that a lot of these people, you know, they're not some evil master villain twisting their handlebar mustache. I mean, these are typically and largely corporations who are looking to do marketing. So if you can get your hands on some medical database and identify all the people with some particular condition, you can then start to direct market to all of those people. If you get your hands on the census data and you can reverse out who they are, you can then look, oh, this person is someone I want to try to offer credit cards to or loans to or deny credit to or what have you. So there's a real economic incentive for people to try to collect as much information as they can, which is really why this whole information gathering and warehousing is becoming such a problem, is everyone wants more accurate targeting to understand their customer, to understand how to market to them, to understand the risks of selling to them or engaging in certain kinds of transactions. You know, information is really becoming the commodity of choice these days on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we come back for our next segment, I'd like to go into a little bit more of that. I can think of one possible example of where this happened to much to the chagrin and surprise of the people involved, and what kind of repercussions there can be from that. So let's go into that a little bit more in depth in our next segment.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
I'm Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world, so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome back to The Social Network Show, where Jim and Dr. J, myself, we are talking with Lance Cottrell of theprivacyblog.com. A wonderful background in encryption and security and privacy. And we were talking about times where with enough, even with not much data, things can be put together to identify people, maybe primarily for marketing. But and I believe this was a case of it. I'm just thinking of the website Patients Like Me, which wherein people put a lot of private medical type information, and someone joined the network under the pretense of being a patient, but was actually a representative of a company that was used a web scraper, and maybe, Lance, you can explain to us what that actually is, but to gather information in which it really ended up that people were identified. So how does that happen? How do people use information to, and I've been trying to find out how they have corrected that problem, but I haven't heard back from them. Lance, what is a web scraper and how does that work?
A web scraper is sort of an automated tool for going through a website and clicking on all the links and, you know, visiting all the different posts in a systematic way, and then grabbing the information off all those pages, which is, you know, often structured data. You've got people who are posting messages in discussion boards, so it's easy to take that text along with all the information about who the person was, automatically go grab their profile information if there's any of that, and then save it off into a database. And it's just much more efficient than having a human do it. You can, with a software scraper, pull down, you know, 100,000 different pages in a day.
Okay, and if you're using an anonymizer or some kind of website that is effective in making yourself not trackable, for instance, does that guard against such activity?
It certainly helps. I mean, they'll still be able to grab your data. Now, a smart website should probably design their systems to make it more difficult to go through and automatically, you know, pull down large quantities of information and recognize people that aren't using the website like a normal real person
mm-hmm.
would. But that's a cat and mouse game. There's obviously then countermeasures the other person can take. The key is, when you're using those kinds of websites, you know, do use the tools to hide your IP address. Do use, you know, probably a pseudonym of some sort. But pay attention to that sort of accumulation of information. If you're putting out your medical condition and, you know, your first name and the street you live on or the neighborhood you're in or age or, you know, all of those little bits of information can add up to be sufficient to then uniquely identify you and allow whoever it is to then try to target you in some way.
I have a quick question. Thank you for that. A quick question about the idea of, well, for example, I sometimes use the IxQuick search engine, and I know StartPage is related to them, but how do you, if you're going to go to IxQuick or one of these other search engines that may help us with some of our privacy, on the way, I mean, how do you get there without going through somewhere where you can be detected? If you know, I don't know if I explained that right, but.
Sure.
Okay.
There's a lot of tools that will allow you to hide your connection in that first hop. So the way anonymizer.com works is when you install our software and turn it on, it sets up an encrypted tunnel between your computer and our servers. So your ISP can't see what you're doing. Anyone in the Starbucks with you can't see what you're doing. We keep no logs of activity whatsoever. So if someone comes to us with a subpoena the next day, we have no idea who was looking at what, when, where, why, how. And then when you connect to the website, what they see as the source is Anonymizer. And there are other people who mm-hmm. provide similar kinds of service, but that would allow you to get out there. You know, it's effective to turn on the privacy mode in your browser, so that it strips out the cookies, because you typically have lots of tracking information in there. And then the next step up, and it's actually a product that we're working on, is to wrap everything in its own virtual machine, so your browser is isolated from your computer to provide that additional level of separation. Because it is really hard to remove all the kinds of different trackers that websites want to put on you. And a lot of people don't realize, when you look at one website, there's often over a dozen companies monitoring the fact that you went there, what you looked mm-hmm. at, how long you spent on every page, can set cookies, and you don't need to click on anything. And just looking at the website, a dozen other companies gets tracking.
Yeah, strangely enough, the dictionary sites have tons of them. And I have a tool that removes cookies as I leave, and it always amazes me, you know, how many there are on a lot of them. You know, that's the computer. What about cell phones? The GPS, for instance, can that serve to identify you?
Yeah, cell phones are incredible tracking devices. I mean, the GPS itself doesn't track you, because it's actually completely passive. You're just listening to the satellites up in space.
Okay.
But once you start using it with a phone, your phone is then connecting to all sorts of other services talking about who you are and where you are. So if you've got a phone on, you're always located by cell tower, and that information is kept by whoever your cellular provider is. If you turn on the maps, you're now talking to Google or Apple or whoever's providing the map service, and they're getting real-time updates on your location. You know, if you're doing check-ins, if you've got, you know, Find My Phone turned on, there's huge numbers of applications on these phones that are continuously asking for your location information and then being able to store it. So, you know, there's multiple paths that one could take to track your motion, you know, around the world. And it turns out location's another one of those interesting identifiers. Someone did a study and said that if they could, with not even that high in accuracy, recognize four locations where you stopped and the times you stopped there, that uniquely fingerprints you within an entire city.
So where do you think, if we take a step back and kind of zoom out here, where do you think all of this is leading? What are the implications for life as we know it?
I think that there really is going to need to be some reevaluation of expectations of privacy. You know, a lot of the laws, a lot of the cases have been settled well before modern technology happened, back when we were in rotary phones and everyone sent letters. And just actually in the last week or so, some Supreme Court case came out talking about privacy with cell phones and the idea that if you are stopped by the police on the street, they're allowed to search you, they're allowed to check your pockets for weapons and so forth. And until just a couple days ago, they could search your cell phone. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court has said that, in fact, you know, that's really a door that opens onto your entire life. We keep everything, our contacts, our history, our email, you know, it's got Dropbox, access to your files, you know, all of your documents. It is far too invasive to just treat like, you know, a post-it note that's stuck in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're going to see a lot more of that, where these online services, even though you don't personally have the data in your possession, they're now out somewhere else. It's going to be treated more and more like your information that's under your control and has expectations of privacy. Because I think the idea of rolling back the clock to a day where we are not putting all that information in the cloud, where it's ubiquitously available on whatever device we happen to be holding in our hands at the moment, isn't going to happen. And it's just too valuable a thing to have. You know, I certainly, you know, I've got four mobile devices sitting in front of me on my desk right now, you know, and so even as a privacy guy, I certainly don't advocate trying to opt out of this.
Mm-hmm. And the you have an interesting entry on your blog about this too, which is again at www.theprivacyblog.com. And really, you post frequently to that and keep us really up to date, so appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
So, tell us about database merging. What is that and how does that affect privacy?
Database merging really comes down to that same kind of issue with de-anonymization, and it's the combination of data that's the thing that comes back to bite people. So you've got one database which contains phone numbers and real name and traffic information and something else. And then you've got something else that may be phone numbers and addresses. And you go, well, phone numbers and addresses don't matter. But now when you combine them, you now have home address with traffic information and whatever. So suddenly when you can cross-index on some unique piece of information or some set of pieces of information that are collectively unique to the individual, suddenly you can take all of the information in database B and then tie it to the stuff in A and get a lot more information about the person than you would have thought from looking at the two databases individually.
Well, what would you recommend in terms of privacy safeguards for the cell phone? We talked a little bit about the computer and, of course, mobile devices. It's all getting really, the line between them is faint anymore. And like the Supreme Court said, with the cell phone is actually a mini computer. What kind of security for the cell phone?
Yeah, I was actually did a speed test on my cell phone not too long ago and realized that it was something like 64 times faster than the original Cray 1 supercomputer, which took up most of a room. So with cell phones, I think the key is, you know, be aware that you're being tracked at all times. So if for some reason you're doing something that you don't want to be tracked, turn it off, take out the battery, leave it behind. Most cell phones will indicate when they're providing your location information. So keep an eye out for that. See when that pops on. Look at which applications are doing it. On the iPhone, there's a location services preferences. So if you go into settings, you can pull those up and think about, do each one of those companies need to have your location? And do you trust them with your location? You know, I think to some extent you want to kind of pick a limited set of people that you trust with different kinds of information, and then don't give it to everyone else, right? The more you can kind of constrain it, the more you can limit the spread. You know, you'll download some game for your phone and it wants access to your address book and your location and everything else. And just make a process, a habit of saying no to those kind of requests.
Right. The frustrating part about this is that we're all so busy as it is, and it's wonderful to have these new devices. But if we have to devote a couple hours to, you know, adjusting all the settings, assuming we know how to do it to begin with, it's rather overwhelming.
It is. And you know, ideally, and the tools are starting to get easier to use. Some companies are doing a better job of putting that information front and center. Mm-hmm. I think Apple's been kind of in the lead on this in terms of trying to design the tools in a more sort of default privacy-friendly way, largely because they're not advertising supported, right? Apple makes money because you pay them, whereas you know someone like Google or Facebook makes money because an advertiser pays them. And so the motivations end up being somewhat different. I think really the key, though, is what do you put in, especially social media. To me, from a privacy point of view, that is just the huge gaping wound in privacy. People treat it as though it is in some way a private space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you just always, in the back of your head, assume anything you post, tweet, you know, comment, tag, is going to be out there for everyone to consume. It'll be captured. It'll be reshared. You know, don't trust these apps that say they're going to delete your content after you send it to actually delete anything you really care about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's fun for casual sharing that's maybe slightly embarrassing, but if you actually care about it being deleted, you can't rely on that.
Right. Oh, thank you so much for joining us. That was Lance Cottrell at theprivacyblog.com. And we really appreciate getting those insights. And thank you for listening. Please mention to your social network that you enjoy the socialnetworkshow.com. And mention it to us as well by subscribing to email updates from the blog page. So have fun and be safe. Online and off, until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests, and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.